You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, my beautiful people. I want to start today by asking you to keep somebody in your prayers. My dear friend and former podcast guest, Lauren McAllister Andrews. She's one of my favorite guests I've ever had. She was so good. She had surgery the day before Thanksgiving on Wednesday with the hope of starting chemo in a few weeks. She's got advanced rectal cancer, which has spread to her organs, I believe. And cancer doesn't know who it's messing with. Lauren is going to beat this thing into submission. I know. What I thought we'd do today, since the holiday season is approaching, I wanted to do some highlights in the book I'm reading right now called The Art of Spending Money by Morgan Housel, which would be a great gift for anyone in your life. I'll have a link in the show notes. And if you use that link, I am paid a small commission, so maybe it'll be enough to buy another copy, because I've already purchased five of them, and I couldn't wait till Christmas. I just started sending them to everybody, and I've gotten quite a few texts of people saying that they love it, and they can't put it down, so it's a really good read, and let's get to it. Otherwise, we might not have time to do the best an update in the best movie ever. Again, the book is called The Art of Spending Money by Morgan Housel, and I'll mix in some of my own commentary here where appropriate, or where I have something to add, at least. And I'll be doing some reading, so I'll let you know when I'm sharing my own thoughts. All right, here we go. There's an old saying that nothing worse than getting what you want, but not what you need. Which that just so happens to be a verse from my favorite Coldplay song. It's from Fix You. He goes on, if you're lucky enough to get what you want, money, you might still realize it's not what you need. Family, friends, health, being part of something bigger than yourself. And then you're disappointed. What could be worse? Winston Churchill famously said that he got more out of alcohol than alcohol got out of him. By the same logic, Housel's writing this, I have seen rich people whose money got more out of them than they got from it, because they spent their life desperately chasing money without any sense of how to use it to make them happier. Many people have figured out how to use money as a tool to provide things that actually make them happier in life. Which, that reminds me of a Naval Ravikant quote, which he talked about intelligence. He said the only true test of intelligence is if you get what you want out of life. All right, back to the book. He says, if you ask parents what they wish for their kids, many will say, I just want them to be happy. Do you want them to be rich and successful? Well, sure, they'll say. But mostly, I just want them to be happy. That makes me think about the fact that we're, as parents, we aren't necessarily raising kids. We're raising adults. We're teaching them to be autonomous. We raise them to someday be well-adjusted, independent adults, independent of us, to function on their own. All right, let me share with you. This is so boneheaded of me, speaking of parenting. My little girl's learning to ride a bike, and she's got this little balance bike that she's really good with. So she's asking Santa for a big girl bike for Christmas, a big girl bike with pedals. So last weekend, I take her with the balance bike to the park where she's going to ride on a trail, and I'll walk beside her. But the trail was too muddy because it had rained the night before. So we went to a different park with a cement trail, and the cement was a little bit slippery. So you knew where this is going. We started on this trail, and I'm walking alongside her, and there's a big decline coming up with a curve. And my daughter said, Daddy, would you ride down? And I said, yeah, I would. And my thought when I was saying that was, I couldn't say that to a son. If I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon, right? No, if I had a son, I couldn't say that I would ride down this curve with my feet up, because a four-year-old boy is likely to try it himself. Well, as I'm walking down, my daughter's walking her bike down, but she's still on it. So her feet are on either side. She's using her feet to walk it down. And then all of a sudden, she goes flying by me. She had fallen a few steps behind, and she just comes flying by me with her feet up. And I'm like, oh, and she's trying to slow herself down by putting her feet down. But there was nothing I could do at this point, and I watched her in slow motion run into the railing and fall off her bike. I felt so terrible. The first thing she said was, "I never want to ride my bike again. I want to go home." Her face was scratched up. It was bleeding. It was not good. And when I asked her later why she did that, she said, "Because you said you would," which made me feel so much worse. Because to me, in saying that I would do it, I thought that would be like telling her that I'd ride a roller coaster. No way, 100% to zero. There's no way I thought that she would ride down this steep decline with a turn. I mean, it looked scary to me. So yeah, the worst part of it was watching her as if in slow motion flying down towards this railing that ultimately stopped her. And yeah, there was no way she could stop her momentum. And I knew she was going to get hurt and I couldn't do anything about it. So I just started running down, and I was hoping she didn't hurt herself too badly, like break any bones or anything. And she didn't, other than her face was scratched up, like I said. So we put some Band-Aids on it. And then the next day, luckily, she wanted to ride her bike again. So that was a relief. But she didn't want to go to school because she didn't like how she looked. And I kept telling her how tough she was, and which was a new word to her, surprisingly. She knows what thing, she knows the word efficient, and she doesn't know tough. So sometimes I'll tell her stuff and she'll say, "Dada, that's too grown-up-y." And as somebody who's always, I've kind of prided myself on, I've always welcomed the challenge to put into words that which could be easier for someone to understand. And just priding myself on being able to simplify things so people can better understand it. Well, having a four-year-old is, I guess the word tough had never been used around her. So yeah, it was, I don't know. Sometimes I just don't know what she doesn't know, and not knowing the word tough, it's a good example. But back to the book. He talks about Carl Jung, one of the most influential psychologists to ever live. He says that Jung once asked, "What do you consider to be more or less basic factors making for happiness in the human mind?" And Jung listed them off. One was good physical and mental health. Again, this is, what do you consider to be more or less basic factors making for happiness in the human mind? And here was Jung's answer. He said, one, good physical and mental health. Two, good personal and intimate relationships, such as those of marriage, the family, and friendships. Three, the faculty for perceiving beauty in art and nature. Four, reasonable standards of living and satisfactory work. Five, a philosophic or religious point of view capable of coping successfully with the vicissitudes of life. Money itself doesn't buy happiness, but it's often an indirect path. Money itself doesn't buy happiness, but it can help you find independence and purpose, both key ingredients for a happier life if you cultivate them. A big, nice house might make you happier, but mostly because it makes it easier to have friends and family over to your house, and the friends and family are actually what's making you happy. The best use of money is a tool to leverage who you are, but never to define who you are. If you're confused about what a better life would look like, one with more money is an easy assumption, but that can sometimes mask deeper problems. Money is so tangible that it's an easy goal to strive for, and pursuing it can become the path of least resistance for those who haven't discovered what truly feeds their soul. That's pretty good, right? Yeah, I've only read to you from the intro so far. So let's get into the book. I'm only about a third of the way through. So if you like what I'm sharing, let me know, and I'll take you through more chapters later in future solo episodes. On the first page of chapter one, he writes, there's a saying, never make fun of someone for mispronouncing a word because it means they learned it from reading. As a corollary, never make fun of how someone spends their money because they learned it from living. On the next page, he references a saying inside the foster care system in America. He says, all behavior makes sense with enough information. Now, I know Housel to be left of center politically, a bit of a bleeding heart, so this isn't a chapter I would have written because it's a little pie in the sky, because I would say you'll never have enough information, so treat people accordingly. But to his credit, he's ultimately making the point about the different ways we spend our money, that if you knew more about how somebody was raised, their upbringing, life experience, you'd better understand why they spend their money the way they do. And regarding his upbringing, I want to say, I believe Housel's politics are probably left because he was raised in Lake Tahoe and San Francisco, and he was a competitive ski racer in Lake Tahoe. And I know his dad was a doctor, and it wouldn't surprise me if his mom's an awful, you know, who knows. But by the way, my own mom is that, so I'm not attacking him by any means. So saying that if you knew more about somebody's upbringing and experience, that you'd better understand why they spend their money the way that they do, that to me seems obvious. But I've never been good at stating the obvious, and it's something that's gotten me in trouble more than once. And it's something I'm always working to get better at, realizing that what's obvious to me isn't obvious to most people. And that holds true for all of us. What you think is obvious isn't obvious to most people. You may have heard me say, if what was obvious to me was obvious to most people, I wouldn't be here doing this. I'd save my breath. All right, next page, still in chapter one. By the way, the title of chapter one is All Behavior Makes Sense with Enough Information. That's the theme of chapter one. So on page three, it says, by the late 1920s, America was at the tail end of a full social and economic cycle. The devastation of World War I was followed by a crippling recession. And then after a decade of misery, finally, people got to relish an economic boom that gave name to the Roaring Twenties. Roaring doesn't do it justice, he writes. It was an absolute party. For a good 5 years in the mid-1920s, the economy was fueled by cheap debt, a stock market bubble, and bootlegged liquor. My thought there, I would think it'd bode well for us that there's already been a Roaring Twenties 100 years ago. Just the 20s being referred to that way, I would think, might make it into our zeitgeist, our collective culture. I don't know, just make it more likely to happen, just the fact that it's happened already. The Roaring Twenties. All right, let's do it again. But we shall see. Here he's quoting somebody else, and I like this one a lot. Robert Quillen. He said, the more you were snubbed while poor, the more you enjoyed displaying your wealth. Housel said that's it. So much of the late 1920s, desire to show off wealth with new cars, new clothes, new toys, was driven by a reaction to the poverty and uncertainty that preceded it. He goes on to say on the next page that people seemed to justify wild, unsustainable spending because they were making up for being snubbed and suppressed during the dour years. They weren't spending wildly because they crunched the numbers and determined it was the right thing to do. They were trying to heal an emotional wound. I know more than one person who grew up in a broken home where their single mom had to struggle to make ends meet. And when they became successful, well-adjusted adults, they justified all their spending, this extreme materialism. They justified it because they grew up poor and work hard in their careers and therefore feel that they deserve the finer things in life. Back to Housel. He writes, spending a ton of money on a college degree might feel like a waste to one person. It might feel like a non-negotiable requirement for another and the ultimate sign of climbing the social ladder to another. The same product has very different meanings to different people. To someone who grew up in an old money affluent family, a Lamborghini might be a symbol of gaudy egotism. Those who grew up with nothing, the car might serve as the ultimate symbol that you've made it. Here's a story I can relate from my own life. My wife once worked with a girl who was probably 25 at the time, and her boyfriend was 30, I think, and he lived in a nice high-rise apartment, and he drove a Lamborghini. And I knew that, I don't even know what he did for a living. I want to say he was doing the Forex trading thing back when a bunch of young guys were into that instead of Bitcoin. Big mistake, right? So learning more about him, we knew that he was raised in an affluent part of Connecticut in the Northeast and now lived in this expensive apartment and drove a Lambo. And so I came to the conclusion, in my mind at least, that the lavish lifestyle he was living was probably supported by his parents. Well, they had been dating, I guess, a year, and the girl got pregnant. So they hurry it up, they got married, make an honest woman out of her, and he died about a month later of brain cancer at age 30. Now, we didn't know he had brain cancer. But there's a strong lesson there that'll stick with me the rest of my life, and I would encourage the same for you, and that is, don't judge a person for how they choose to spend their money. Who would blame a guy who's dying of brain cancer for driving a Lambo on his last days on earth? I wouldn't. I know a lot of guys, maybe myself included at one time, although I'd like to think I wouldn't have done this, but and that is to treat or assume that the 30-year-old driving a Lambo and living the high life is some D-bag and would treat him accordingly and treat him like that. And I disagree with that. So let people spend their money how they want. And what's it to you anyway? I mean, you don't know what's going on with them at all sometimes. All right, next page. He writes, never have I seen money burn a hole in someone's pocket faster than an investment banker receiving their annual bonus. After 12 months of Excel modeling until 3 a.m., you have an urge to prove yourself that it was worth it, offsetting what you sacrificed. It's like someone held underwater for a minute. They don't take a calm breath when they surface. They gasp. A lot of spending is gasping. Related, he says, I have noticed that those most capable of delayed gratification are from those who enjoy their work. The pay might be good, but the urge to compensate for your hard work with heavy spending isn't there. I can relate to that too. So, especially as it relates to the fire thing, I've always said that it isn't something I would have been able to do if I didn't enjoy my job. But I studied the craft. I never dreaded going to work. Never got the Sunday blues. I liked my routine. I enjoyed helping people and finding solutions to problems. And I just enjoyed getting after it and getting better every day. And that enabled me to, of course, to make more money and ultimately walk away when I did. But yeah, it's always the guy who hates his job who wants to quit and retire. But it's harder to get there if you don't like your job, right? It's going to take longer. All right, back to the book. I think it's a deep sign of immaturity to think that because you like spending your money a certain way, other people should too. It's a sign of deep immaturity to think that because you don't value something, no one else should either. That's not how the world works. Then he's talking about how different people's life experiences can be, and saying that an impoverished child from Africa grows up learning to be scared of things that a rich kid in California isn't scared of. That a rich child in Manhattan grows up learning to seek joy from different things than a farmer in Iowa. And he writes, the most basic and seemingly fundamental feelings of joy, fear, shame, and pride vary from culture to culture, family to family, person to person. Behavior that embarrasses you might make me proud. You know, I was asked one time on the pod, I think it was Harvey Juergen, asked me if I ever get embarrassed. And I said that I didn't want to say that because somebody will find a way to embarrass me. So I don't think I'm incapable of embarrassment, but I would say it doesn't happen often. And I guess I couldn't be that easily embarrassed, right, with all that I share with you. But there's a Naval quote that's applicable here too. He said, guilt is just society's voice in your head, meaning that guilt is an internal, it's not a personal feeling. I mean, yeah, you probably feel terrible, that terrible feeling, but he's emphasizing the fact that it's just an external voice of social programming that's been internalized by you. You ever wonder why addicts share their story, regardless of any embarrassment or shame that they might face by being so candid? It's for a lot of reasons. One, typically, addicts have hit rock bottom before they get help and lose their job and their relationship and their money and their dignity. And some of them even steal from their loved ones to support their drug habit. I know a guy who was very successful by all objective measures. He owned he had a little dealership, a car dealership in Georgia, and he was making about $350 a year. Beautiful wife, two kids, they were 13 and 11, and he was spending $30,000 a month on heroin and cocaine. Every bit of his income, actually a little more, right, if you do the math. And fortunately, he was able to get help and turn his life around, but not before his family went through some terrible times. And after years of that, coming out as an addict seems trivial by comparison for all the hurt you've caused. And just the act of saying, I did some terrible things, I hurt some people, but I'm still worthy of love and care from the people I love, you know, that's profoundly liberating. It helps to beat embarrassment into submission. They also know that sharing their story can be a difference between somebody picking up the phone and calling for help or dying of a drug overdose, because most people who are addicted to drugs isolate. And, you know, the in all likelihood, the guy in recovery heard someone else's story, like I heard the Wolf of Wall Street on a podcast, and then you feel some obligation to pay it forward. You never know who's listening, and they might go and seek the help that they need. So that potential to help even one person outweighs any lingering fear you might have of being judged. Besides, by speaking openly about it, you're fighting the stigma that's attached to addiction. You know, that guy's a loser, or that guy's a pillhead, or whatever. And they know, addicts know, that silence is what kills you. And it's not just emotions that vary. What's common sense to one culture can seem absurd and backward to another. Psychologist, and I would add great author, Jonathan Haidt points out that a 25-year-old son addressing his father by his first name is perfectly acceptable in America, but deemed morally wrong, universally wrong, by other cultures. Yeah, I probably shared this before, but where I grew up in Louisiana, we refer to our friends' parents as Miss or Mr., and then first name. And then when I got to Houston, my friends' parents were referred to by their first name, which seemed so disrespectful to me, but everybody was doing it. And that was the name you called them. Here is maybe one of my favorite quotes from the book. It says, "Personal finance is more personal than finance." That is so true. Personal, in my mind, means behavioral, how you behave with money. Next chapter. Living a good life is one of the most complicated topics that philosophers have debated for thousands of years. And more money is such an easy and quantifiable thing to chase. But the desire for more money and the things it can buy often obscures what you really want, respect and admiration from other people. And he shares letters from... Okay, so he's written these letters to each of his kids. He says, "I wrote both of them that you might think you want a nicer car and a bigger house, but I'm telling you, you don't. What you actually want is respect and admiration from other people, and you think that having nice stuff will bring it, but it rarely does, at least as much as you expected." Then he gets into the reverse obituary, writing down what you want your obituary to say. Can I just call it an obit? He suspects that you want your obituary, your obit, to say you were loved, you were respected, you were admired, you were helpful. You were a good parent, a good spouse, a caring friend. You were an asset to your community. You made a contribution to your industry. You were wise, funny, and smart. Now, he says, realize what's not in there. Almost no one on this exercise would think about their obituary mentioning how much horsepower their car has, how many square feet their home is, or how much they spend on clothes. Your salary wouldn't be mentioned, nor how many carats are in your wedding ring, nor that you redid your kitchen with imported Italian marble. A few pages later, he writes, "There are cases when people's desire to show off fancy stuff is because it's their last remaining or even only way to gain respect and admiration. If you struggle to gain respect and admiration through your intelligence, humor, empathy, or capacity for love, you might default to the only remaining and least effective lever, your stuff." All right, page 19, he gets into how spending money on stuff to impress people isn't the most durable thing you could do. The question he poses is, who's paying attention? Mostly strangers. And he says, when a stranger notices your car, he's gawking at the car, not at you. He asks, does your spouse notice your car? Your parents, do they notice your car? Close friends, your kids? He says, of course, but it's the last thing that they would use to measure how much they respect and admire you. They care much more about how funny and kind and intelligent and helpful and loving you are. He says, spending money is the fastest way to get someone's attention, but it's not durable attention. That's what he means by durable. Comparing spending money to impress people to eating junk food is what you should do. Very tempting, he says, immediately satisfying, but it's long-term damaging. To further illustrate his point, I love this line. He says, my guess is that if your favorite comedian, actor, or athlete turned out to be broke, your opinion of them wouldn't change much. It wouldn't change how much you admire them because you admire them for talents money can't buy. Oh, this is good too. On page 20, he shares something that Chad Johnson said. That's Ocho Cinco to you and me. He said, there's no need to show off your material wealth when your name is so big. People already respect and admire you for your talents alone. If you can get to a point in your career where your name becomes bigger than anything you can purchase, there's your value. He said, there's nothing I can buy that is bigger than my name alone. So it made no sense to buy jewelry. It's pointless. Steve Jobs and Elon Musk are good examples of this. Steve Jobs famously didn't have furniture in his house. And Elon Musk, he doesn't even own a house. Morgan Housel writes, bottom line is, if you get your respect and admiration for who you are rather than what you own, your desire to spend more money on flashy things plummets. Let's check in on the best movie ever. Let's see what's going on. I saw where the Democrat senator from Arizona, Ruben Gallego is his name. He had his text messages leaked by a friend that he was sending texts to. Some friend, right? He said, dim women look like dim men, and dim men look like women. Yeah, if my texts were leaked, they'd probably say the same thing. I don't know much about this senator, but I do like him because, you know, real recognize real. And because he hasn't apologized. And why would you ever apologize for speaking the truth? You wouldn't. He doesn't. Do you remember the attorney for Trump who was caught up in the Big Fanny case in Georgia, a gal by the name of Jenna Ellis? She is such a good example of what has ailed us in America. I saw Tim Pool said it best, maybe. He said, when they, the Democrats, come after your way of life, Jenna Ellis basically said, okay, but just don't hurt me. So just to give you a refresher, Jenna Ellis took a plea deal and lost her law license and was put on probation and fines and community service, all of that. And the case was ultimately dropped last week with the court saying it's not illegal to challenge the results of an election. But she's got a lot of Twitter followers. Maybe she can sell something to them. Of course, the biggest story in the best movie ever was the what we're calling the Seditious Six, because they did the most chicken shit thing, making a video, basically creating a political issue, creating something out of nothing, because they haven't come with ideas lately to make the country better or anything like that. They're just the anti-Trump party. So they make a video telling the military and intelligence community that they can disobey orders. They said illegal orders, but they wouldn't name what an illegal order would be. They didn't give an example. They just know that, I assume they know that there are crazies here in America and terror cells that they've imported that will act. Because a few days later, we had two National Guardsmen who were tragically killed by some Afghan who was brought over after that withdrawal of our troops in Afghanistan, where people were hanging off the plane trying to flee the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whatever. And Mayorkas admitted that they weren't vetted. And I know many leftists are celebrating on apps like Blue Sky. I saw where some congressman was like, whose side are you on? Isn't that obvious? It's obvious which side they're on. I don't think they realize how close we are to civil war. It would take one bullet in one person's head, and I think we'd be there. So America needs a divorce. That's what I think. Let's work out a settlement. The community property divided up. Give the communists maybe the entire northwest of the country and Hawaii or something. And in 15 years, we'll see the difference like we see Dominican Republic and Haiti. You know, the results of the divorce 15 years from now. Because a communist needs money to steal from the producers, and they wouldn't have it after a few years. That's all I got for you today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope y'all had a great Thanksgiving. And I will chat back at you next time. I appreciate your prayers for Lauren. Thank you, folks.